Greetings, my name is Todd Lorenz. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 8 of That's What I Think, But I Could Be Wrong. Violence and psychiatric medication, is there a connection? My website is toddlorenz.com. I drop a new show every Thursday morning. I think cryptids exist that science should recognize. I don't think Lee Harvey Oswald had a thing to do with the murder of John F. Kennedy. I don't think we know the truth about what happened on 9/11. I think the United States should meddle in foreign affairs as little as possible. And I believe the vast majority of politicians are corrupt. But hey, that's just what I think. And I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe and I say it's strong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Hey there, thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. Thanks for downloading, streaming, whatever you do to access the media on whatever form you choose. If you have not given me a positive review or rating on the media of your choice, please do so. It helps me grow the show and hopefully monetize it. Now, the topic this week, well, it might be a little touchy. It's no secret that violence is a problem in our country, and specifically mass shootings happen way too frequently. And of course, they're heavily covered by the media. And it occurred to me to wonder, and I certainly wasn't the first, is there a connection between taking psychiatric or psychotropic medications and episodes of violence, particularly the mass shootings? Now, why would I wonder that? Well, it's become a topic for discussion in both the mainstream and alternate media, as well as any number of bloggers and doctors and so-called experts. And we're kind of bombarded with ads for different drugs to treat various illnesses, including mental illnesses. And often it seems like the side effects are worse than what the drug is supposed to cure or treat. We don't really cure anything anymore, do we? But that's another discussion. So I found some stats. The use of antidepressants in America has skyrocketed. As of 2013, 5 years ago, 12% of Americans were filling prescriptions for them. Why would that be? Well, because they're mentally ill? Well, maybe. But maybe it's a product of advertising. Pharmaceutical companies were estimated to spend $6.4 billion on direct-to-consumer advertising in 2016, according to USA Today. So stop and think about that. Why would they be doing that? Well, we're in a capitalistic society. It's all about making money, profit. If they're spending that much, they're making a hell of a lot more, I promise you. And as I have said before, when it comes to any given problem, follow the money. But is it really that simple? Well, that's part of our discussion. Let's start by talking about whether or not this type of behavior is actually new to our world. I found an article titled Mass Shootings, the New Manifestation of an Ancient Phenomenon and Their Link to Psychiatric Drugs. It was written by Ali LeVere, and it appears on a website called kellybroganmd.com. The article begins with the following. Individuals perpetrating unspeakable acts of violence is not a new phenomenon. What's new, rather, are the altered states of consciousness induced by antidepressants and other psychotropic drugs well documented to promote homicidal and suicidal behavior in susceptible individuals. The article then goes on and compares the term or phrase running amok to today's mass shootings. Used in colloquial verbiage to indicate an irrational individual wreaking havoc, the linguistic origins of running amok stem from the description of a mentally perturbed individual that engages in unprovoked, homicidal, and subsequently suicidal behavior, oftentimes involving an average of 10 victims. This was classified as a psychological condition in 1849. Now, while it was once considered a rare psychiatric and culture-bound syndrome, researcher Dr. Manuel St. Martin argues that amok is also prevalent in contemporary industrialized societies. Dr. Martin postulates that the escalating frequency of mass homicides in industrial cultures in the past quarter century represents amok, citing that attackers often have a history of mental disturbance and that modern-day episodes involve similar numbers of victims. The article goes on to say that while Amok explains the deep-seated human tendency to engage in acts of violence, and we kind of discussed whether or not humans are inherently violent on a previous show, it does nothing to explain the recent increase in frequency. Many argue that access to semi-automatic weapons explains the explosion in mass shootings, but one long-neglected element of the conversation is that the recent rise in mass homicides coincides with the greatest use of cognition-altering psychiatric drugs ever observed in human history. However, a perusal of academic research reveals that psychotropic drugs may be contributing to the epidemic of mass shootings. In 2011, 26.8 million adults in the United States used pharmaceutical drugs for mental illness. 2 years later, the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey found that nearly 17% of American adults filled at least one prescription for a psychiatric drug. Those numbers are different than the ones I quoted earlier, aren't they? What's correct? Hard to say. The article then goes on to discuss the horrible Las Vegas shooting, which left at least 58 people dead, and states that preliminary reports indicate the alleged killer was prescribed Valium, a sedative hypnotic drug classified as a benzodiazepine. The article also says there have been 46 studies published in the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry, which illuminated that an association between benzodiazepine use and subsequent aggressive behavior was found in the majority of more rigorous studies, especially in those individuals with an underlying propensity toward anxiety and hostility. In addition, a prospective cohort study of nearly 1,000 Finnish subjects published in the journal World Psychiatry demonstrated that current use of benzodiazepines elevated risk of homicide by 45% compared to controls. That sounds rather damning, doesn't it? But we are talking about our country, the United States, and those studies mentioned were not here, but they still would seem to be relevant, wouldn't they? What other evidence did I find? Well, how about a peer-reviewed research article utilizing FDA data titled Prescription Drugs Associated with Reports of Violence Towards Others by Thomas J. Moore, Joseph Glenmullen, and Kurt D. Ferberg, published December 15, 2010. The article concludes, acts of violence towards others are a genuine and serious adverse drug event associated with a relatively small group of drugs. Varenicline, which increases the availability of dopamine, and antidepressants with serotonergic effects were the most strongly and consistently implicated drugs. Prospective studies to evaluate systematically the side effect are needed to establish the incidence, confirm differences among drugs, and identify additional common features. So they conclude that acts of violence are a genuine side effect of a relatively small group of drugs, and also that further study is needed. What other side effects are there? Zoloft can cause hallucinations, agitation, and memory problems. Prozac can cause suicidal thoughts, self-mutilation, and manic behavior. Valium can cause hallucinations, depression, and thoughts of suicide. So, like I said earlier, sometimes it seems like the possible side effects are not worth the treatment. Pair those up with someone who has some serious mental issues, perhaps violent tendencies, and it seems like a recipe for disaster. And let's take a look at a few examples, shall we? I put together a small timeline of shootings and the possible influence of psychiatric medication. 1988, 31-year-old Laurie Dan went on a shooting rampage in a second-grade classroom in Illinois, killing one child and wounding six. She had been taking the antidepressant anafronil as well as lithium, long used to treat mania. In 1989, 47-year-old Joseph T. Westbecker shot 20 workers in a Louisville, Kentucky factory, killing nine people just a month after he began taking Prozac. The drug maker, Eli Lilly and Company, later settled a lawsuit brought by survivors. Also in 1989, 25-year-old Patrick Purdy murdered 5 children and wounded 30 in a schoolyard shooting rampage in Stockton, California. He'd been taking amitriptyline, an antidepressant, as well as the antipsychotic drug Thorazine. In 1997, in Paducah, Kentucky, 14-year-old Michael Carniel, son of a prominent attorney, traveled to Heath High School and started shooting students, killing 3 and leaving another paralyzed. He reportedly was on Ritalin. 1998, 15-year-old Oregon shooter Kip Kinkle opened fire in his school cafeteria. He was on Prozac. In 1999, Columbine killer Eric Harris was taking Luvox. According to author David Kopelian from his book, How Evil Works, quote, Luvox manufacturer Solvay Pharmaceuticals concedes that during short-term controlled clinical trials, 4% of children and youth taking Luvox, that's 1 in 25, developed mania, a dangerous and violence-prone mental derangement characterized by extreme excitement and delusion, end quote. 2005, 16-year-old Jeff Weiss, living in Minnesota on an Indian reservation, shot and killed 9 people and wounded 5 others before killing himself. He'd been on Prozac. 2007, Virginia Tech shooter Sung Hui Cho shot and killed 32 people. According to the New York Times, officials found prescription medicine related to the treatment of psychological problems among his personal belongings. 2012, Colorado theater shooter James Holmes was reportedly prescribed the antidepressant Zoloft. 2013, Navy Yard shooter Aaron Alexis sprayed bullets at office workers and in a cafeteria, killing 13 people, including himself. He'd been prescribed Trazodone by his Veterans Affairs doctor. 2013, Jose Reyes, a Nevada 7th grader who went on a shooting rampage in his school in October, was taking Prozac. 2014, Elliot Roger, the Isla Vista, California killer, went on a shooting spree after stabbing 3 men to death. He'd been prescribed psychotropic drugs, according to the LA Times. Also in 2014, Aaron Ray Ibarra, 26, of Mount Lake Terrace, Washington, allegedly opened fire with a shotgun at Seattle Pacific University in June, killing 1 student and wounding 2 others. Ibarra said he'd been prescribed Prozac and Risperdal to help him with his problems. And of course, 2017, Las Vegas shooter Stephen Paddock, according to the Las Vegas Review-Journal, was on Valium. I also found 2 other cases that, while did not involve mass shootings, struck me as particularly heinous and allegedly involved psychiatric meds. On June 20th, 2001, Andrea Yates, in one of the most heartrending crimes in modern history, drowned all 5 of her children, aged 7 years down to 6 months, in a bathtub. She insisted voices commanded her to kill her children, and she had become increasingly psychotic over the course of several years. In essence, she insisted Satan told her to do it. She had been taking the antidepressant Effexor. In November of 2005, more than 4 years after Yates drowned her children, Effexor manufacturer Wyeth Pharmaceuticals quietly added homicidal ideation to the drug's list of rare adverse events. The Medical Accountability Network publicly criticized Wyeth, saying Effexor's homicidal ideation risk was not well publicized and that Wyeth failed to send letters to doctors or issue warning labels announcing the change. As for what rare in the phrase rare adverse events means, the FDA defines it as occurring in less than 1 in 1,000 people. But since that same year, 19.2 million prescriptions for Effexor were filled in the U.S. Statistically, that means thousands of Americans might experience murderous thoughts as a result of taking just this one brand of antidepressant. Effexor is the company's best-selling drug, which in one recent year brought in over $3 billion in sales, accounting for almost a fifth of the company's annual revenues. So you can connect those dots if you like. On November 28th, 2001, 12-year-old Christopher Pittman murdered his grandparents. He testified that, "When I was lying in my bed that night, I couldn't sleep because my voice in my head kept echoing through my mind, telling me to kill them." That night, he shot both of his grandparents in the head with a .410 shotgun as they slept, and then burned down their South Carolina home where he lived with them. "I got up, got the gun, and I went upstairs and I pulled the trigger. Through the whole thing, it was like watching your favorite TV show. You know what is going to happen, but you can't do anything to stop it." Pittman's lawyers would later argue that the boy had been a victim of involuntary intoxication, since his doctors had him taking antidepressants Paxil and Zoloft just prior to the murders. Paxil's known adverse drug reactions, according to the FDA, include mania, insomnia, anxiety, agitation, confusion, amnesia, depression, paranoid reaction, psychosis, hostility, delirium, hallucinations, abnormal thinking, depersonalization, and lack of emotion, among others. Based on what we've discussed so far, it would seem there is a really clear connection between violence and psychiatric medication. But you know what? Every coin has two sides. Peter Langman has written two books, School Shooters: Understanding High School, College, and Adult Perpetrators, and Why Kids Kill: Inside the Minds of School Shooters. He received his BA in psychology from Clark University, his MA in counseling psychology from Lesley College, and his PhD in counseling psychology from Lehigh University. He authored an article titled Psychiatric Medications and School Shootings that was released in February of 2016. Now, he agrees that there has been an increase in the use of psychiatric medications. Between 1987 and 1996, the use of psychostimulants such as Ritalin increased nearly fourfold, and the use of antidepressants by adolescents ages 15 to 18 increased over fourfold. Similarly, there was a 75% increase in the use of antidepressants from 1996 to 2005. There is no question that the use of psychiatric medications has grown substantially in the last 25 years. But he argues that the problem with blaming medications for murder is that though there has been a significant increase in the use of psychiatric meds, there has not been a corresponding increase in violence. In fact, just the opposite has occurred. Violent crime has decreased dramatically. And he provides statistics to back it up. I will include a link to the paper on my website. He also has a problem with some of the information that has been presented out on the web and elsewhere. Specifically, three of the cases I mentioned earlier. In 1997, the shooting involving Michael Carniol in Paducah, Kentucky, according to Dr. Langman, he went off of Prozac in the fall of 1997, and the shooting was not until the following May. He maintains Carniol was not on any medications at the time of the shooting. Same thing with the 15-year-old Oregon shooter Kip Kinkle and the Virginia Tech shooter Swung Hui Cho in 2007. Dr. Langman reports that Cho's autopsy report stated he had no prescription drugs or toxic substances in his system. As you might recall, the New York Times reported that officials found prescription medication related to the treatment of psychological problems among his personal belongings. If that was the case, he apparently had not been taking them, which perhaps was the problem. So earlier I gave you 14 examples of shooters where psychiatric medications were thought to contribute to their heinous acts. Three of them apparently do not involve meds in any way. How many of the others are possibly false? Hard to say for sure. In any case, I recommend you read Dr. Langman's paper. It's fascinating, and I won't go over all of it. However, I will cover some of his summary. He says, "The belief that psychiatric medications cause school shootings is not supported at either the societal or the individual level. At the societal level, the argument that the rise in the use of psychiatric drugs has caused a corresponding rise in violence and homicide does not hold water for the simple fact that there has been no corresponding rise in violence and homicide, just the opposite. Over a 20-year period, violent crime in general and homicides by youths in particular decreased significantly. Medications cannot be blamed for a crisis of mania, murder, and mayhem because there is no such crisis. The argument at the level of individual shooters is damaged by the frequent errors made by people espousing their views, including inaccurate claims about which shooters took medications, whether they were on medications at the time of their attacks, and the effects the medications actually had on them. The concern about adverse effects of psychiatric medications is a legitimate concern and worthy of ongoing research. This concern, however, is not well served by assumptions, misinformation, and innuendo in the place of facts. That sounds pretty definitive, doesn't it? Well, he's not the only one with that opinion. An article published in the LA Times on May 7th, 2014 states, a study finds that people who are mentally ill are less likely to commit crimes when they take antipsychotic or mood-stabilizing medications. Finally, my last reference will be to an article published in February 2015 in the American Journal of Public Health. The article is titled, Mental Illness, Mass Shootings, and the Politics of American Firearms, and was written by Jonathan M. Metzl, M.D. and Ph.D., and Kenneth T. McLeish, Ph.D. Their article looks at four central assumptions that frequently arise in the aftermath of mass shootings. 1. Mental illness causes gun violence. 2. Psychiatric diagnosis can predict gun crime before it happens. 3. U.S. mass shootings teach us to fear mentally ill loners. And 4. Because of the complex psychiatric histories of mass shooters, gun control won't prevent another Tucson, Aurora, or Newtown. The paper addresses the issues in depth, and I think it's worth your time to read it if you're at all interested. But for the purposes of this podcast, I think this excerpt from the summary works nicely. Mass shootings represent national awakenings and moments when seeming political or social adversaries might come together to find common ground, whether guns are allowed, regulated, or banned. Doing so, however, means recognizing that gun crimes, mental illnesses, social networks, and gun access issues are complexly interrelated and not reducible to simple cause and effect. Ultimately, the ways our society frames these connections reveal as much about our particular cultural politics, biases, and blind spots as it does about the acts of lone and obviously troubled individuals. Okay, so where do I come down on all this? Is there a connection between violence and psychiatric medication? I gotta tell you, and it's a little shameful, I went into the research for this podcast fully expecting there to be a connection. I'd read articles before, I'd looked at the issue lightly, and it satisfied myself that a lot of the time, not all the time, psychiatric meds can be more dangerous than the conditions they're used to treat. Now I'm not so sure. And why not? Well, you've heard it. I cited plenty of cases, and there are more out there, of reports in the media, online and otherwise, where people who have committed unspeakable acts of violence did so while on medication or sometimes while coming off of it. And I do believe we as a society are overly medicated. I don't believe it's so much an advance in medicine as much as it is a cash grab, along with the principle of no longer curing disease or problems. It's far more profitable to treat someone forever than it is to cure them. But you know what? I know a number of people who are on medications for mental conditions. None of them have committed horrible acts of violence against other people. Does that mean there never is a connection? No, I don't think so. But does it say more about the fact that they're medicated, or the fact that they're troubled and then medicated. In other words, is the medication causing a problem, or are these just troubled people that happen to be medicated? It's hard to say. I believe this, though. When drug companies admit to side effects in writing, I think it's a pretty safe bet that there is more there than they're willing to admit. Just my opinion, I have nothing to back that up. We talked about the case of Andrea Yates, where she was on Effexor, and 4 years after she drowned all her kids in a bathtub, the company quietly adds the rare adverse event of homicidal ideation. Yeah, isn't that fantastic? And as I said earlier, they make a pile of money from that drug. But here's the thing. It seems to me that these drugs, more often than not, help people. Again, consider the number of people that have been on medication. In 2011, 26.8 million adults in the United States used pharmaceutical drugs for mental illness. 2 years later, 17% of American adults filled at least one prescription for a psychiatric drug. Clearly, the majority of people did not go out and commit mass murder. I am concerned about how often children are prescribed psychiatric medications that, to me, kind of mess with their brain chemistry. Our brains aren't finished developing until we're about 25, give or take. The idea of messing with kids' minds with medications seems like a last resort to me, and maybe it often is. But as I said earlier, there has been an increase to medications for children as well. Just from personal experience, when I was in school, there was no such thing as Ritalin. There was no such thing as attention deficit disorder. You had kids that were a little hyper, but they learned to deal, usually through discipline. Maybe the discipline's lacking now. I don't know. I don't have children. I have talked to some parents who told me that, yeah, ADD and ADHD are real things, and their kids need to be on medication. Respectfully, I find it difficult to believe. But admittedly, I have no kids, and I'm not in their shoes. I will say that if I had children, medicating them would be more than a last resort. I'm not even sure I would ever do it, no matter what. I suppose there are circumstances under which I would, but I'm hard-pressed to come up with one. If my kids were in school and the school said they have to be medicated or they're not coming back, I wouldn't send them back. Partly because I'm not letting some school dictate how I handle my kids. And again, that's a whole nother issue. Okay, so after all this talking, what's my take? Is there a connection between violence and psychiatric medication? A very small percentage of the time, yes. And if so, are we willing to live with that? If we at some point discover strong, indisputable evidence of a connection between psychiatric medications and violence, specifically mass shootings, do we continue to medicate people when the vast majority of people are helped or suffer no horrible side effects? That's really the question to me. Our Constitution gives us the right to bear arms. Those arms are often used in the commissions of a crime, yet that right remains intact. It's considered a God-given right for us to be able to defend ourselves with firearms when necessary. Are we willing to give up that right in order to prevent people from using guns to do harm? So far, no, the majority of us are not. And I agree with that. Can we apply the same sentiment to psychiatric medications? If that's the case, when it comes down to it, yes, I think we can. Of course, I've never lost someone to a mass shooting. I've never had a kid murdered during a school shooting. If I did, I suspect I might feel differently. But that's why these issues have to be decided by those who don't have a connection. Cooler heads prevail. That's the way things should work. But you know what? That's just my opinion. And I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe and I say it's strong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Thank you for listening. I truly appreciate it, and I'd really love a positive review on Apple Podcasts or whatever media you use to get to my show. It'll help me grow the podcast and hopefully monetize it within the reasonably near future. If you did not like the show, well, tell you what, why don't you try another episode? Maybe you'll enjoy it more. I can be reached at podcast@toddlorenz.com. My website is toddlorenz.com. You'll find this show along with all of my music. And that brings us to the song of the week. Once again, I'm choosing something from my 2014 album, Hope. This is called F.U., the kinder, gentler version. Thank you again for listening, and I will talk to you next week.
If you're easily offended, like you, if you choose to be ignorant, like you, if you have a closed mind, you quit before you try, if you'd rather pout and whine, like you. You're a crooked politician, like you, you're an ambulance chaser, fuck you. If you make your living purposely deceiving, if you never start giving, fuck you. Fuck you. If you're needlessly cruel, fuck you. If you never think of others, or you never call your mother, if you don't love your brother, fuck you. If you're excessively religious, fuck you. If you don't think what you're saying, fuck you. If you're blindly devoted to a book and all devoted, if you can't see beyond it, fuck you. Like it, oh, fuck you. If you talk at the movies, fuck you. If you like to cut in line, or you're late all the time, if you think I don't mind, fuck you. If you lack basic kindness, fuck you. If you don't get empathy, fuck you. If you don't have passion, it's beyond your understanding to be perfect. You. You're afraid of global warming. You insist that I recycle. You. If you think Mother Nature is any kind of danger, well, it's just the climate change. Fuck you. You're the global elitist. Fuck you. You trash the Constitution. Fuck you. If you want to take my rights, be prepared for a fight. In the name of freedom, fuck you. In the name of freedom, fuck you.